This evening, what I'd like to do is start a little bit of an idea that we'll spend a couple of weeks on. And it is interesting because one of the things that we do often is we often use a lot of vocabulary. Okay, all of you are familiar, most of us are familiar with a lot of different phrases and terms and things that we use. And so rather than try to say certain things, we will use a phrase or we will use terminology that is relevant to our ideology. One of the phrases that is very, very common now in this present day and age, especially in Jewish circles, mostly in Jewish circles, although it has been used by secular, even past presidents and whatever, no matter whether they were good or bad, they still had the idea and used and thought of the idea, and that is the phrase Tikkun Olam, or Tikkun HaOlam, as it is in many different places. Okay, so one of the things I want to do to begin with is, how many of you have a siddur with you? How many of you can get to a siddur pretty quick? You don't have to if you don't have one. But if you have the siddur that we commonly use, I want you to go to page 123. Most of you, especially those who are well-versed in the siddur, know that the prayer we're going to talk about for just a minute is Aleinu. In this prayer, we use...
Rabbi?
Yes, ma'am?
Is it the Sabbath book or the daily?
Yeah, the Sabbath siddur is the what I'm looking at. It's on page 123. We usually say this, if you look at page 123, we say Aleinu, and then right after we do Aleinu, we do Yigdal. Now, I love Yigdal, and I guess the reason I love Yigdal is just that melody with Yigdal is just very, very catching, and it's very, very... to me, it's very moving. But Aleinu has a very, very important structure to it. And if you study this prayer, you can go to the Jewish Encyclopedia. I don't necessarily recommend Wikipedia, but you can go to several of the different sites and they'll talk about Aleinu. And I have a little book that is an encyclopedia of Jewish prayer. And according to the Encyclopedia of Jewish Prayer, one of the things that is relevant or important about the Aleinu is that it is very old. Okay? Some people suggest that it is, relatively new, etc. But it's actually even reported that maybe this is the prayer that Joshua used when he was confronting Jericho. Now, that I cannot verify or say, but the point here is that the prayer is very, very old, okay? And this becomes very important to us because obviously most of us came to the place that we're at as far as faith and practice and becoming Jewish. And we came to that place because we started our walk in Yeshua. He may have been, for us in the beginning, Jesus, but now we see Yeshua. And for me, when I say Yeshua, I am not making any type of reference to Jesus and the ideology that I held or we held in the past. So for me, when I try to study things, I want to know if Yeshua may have been involved in any of these prayers or any of these things. And in this particular prayer, is old enough that it goes well beyond the first century. So Yeshua was definitely attuned to the idea of the Elenu, okay? Now, the Elenu is very important primarily for the sake of talking about the kingdom, okay? If you had any knowledge of me in the past when I talked or taught, whether it be in Christian circles or even my early teachings in, quote, Jewish circles or with relation to the Jewishness of Yeshua, etc., you know I love to talk about the kingdom. And for the longest time, I've never had a honest awareness of what the kingdom really was. But one of the things that, just as a definition to know, is that the kingdom is obviously the governance of God, but it comes through agents or agency. God always, in his kingdom, always uses agents, okay? So if you look at the secular world today, they're using agents, right? We have policemen, we have mayors, we have all of these people who are mitigating the legal structure of the world around us. So in some sense, there's a mimic of what happens in the ideology of Judaism and what it's trying to say. So what I want to do is I'm going to read through this prayer, and then I'm going to bring you to a place where it says something, and then I'm going to look at a couple of different passages from the Tanakh, and we're going to look at some of these things, and we'll get a basic foundation for the idea of Tikkun Olam, what Tikkun Olam means, okay? Because we use this, we say Tikkun Olam. Every time we turn around, we're saying something about, you know, it's Tikkun Olam. So we say Tikkun Olam, and we say this Tikkun Olam, you know, we assume that everybody else understands everything about that idea, and so we just don't try to make any definition. But I think it's important for us to understand it in greater depth. And what I want to try to do this week and next week and possibly one more after that is to unfold this idea. We may get to the fundamental idea by the end of this class, but you will understand once we have talked about it to that level that it is a very, very complex subject. It's a very complex idea. And it takes a lot of interaction on our part, but we don't really realize how much we should be involved in this idea and how prominent it should be in our ideas. One thing I'll say to begin with is that if you look into, there are places where this phrase does occur in the Tanakh. And then when you started to come into rabbinic literature, such as the Talmuds, both of the Talmuds, Jerusalem or the Babylonian Talmud, this phrase first started in a tractate called Gittin. Gittin is about gets. Everybody know what a get is? A get is a bill of divorcement, okay? So Tikkun Olam had the idea of seeing women, don't get carried away, but is that women were given what was rightfully or what rightfully belonged to them. And so it was an idea of women's rights, what they should be having, not having some husband who had a lot of money and then he tries to somehow circumvent giving the money to his spouse, etc., okay? All right, so we'll try to get through some of those ideas, but the thing to notice is that in history past, it has not been an ultra used word. It's not been used heavily in the past, and only in recent times has the idea of Tikkun Olam really come to the forefront. Okay, and so we'll talk about that more as we go along. Okay, so Elenu, and it says, it is incumbent upon us to give praise to the master of everything, to attribute greatness to the molder of creation, For he did not make us like the nations of the lands, nor did he establish us like the families of the earth. For he did not assign us our portion to be like theirs, nor our lot like all of their multitudes. For they prostrate themselves to futility and emptiness, and they pray to a God that cannot help. But we prostrate ourselves before he who is the King over kings of kings, the Holy One, blessed be he, who spreads out the heavens and establishes the earth, and the seat of his glory is in the heavens above, and the divine presence of his power is in the highest of heights. He is our God, and there is no other. Our King is true, and there is nothing besides him, as it is written in the Torah, and you shall know today and take to your heart that Adonai, who is God, in the heavens above and above all the earth, and there is no other. Therefore, we place our hope in you, Adonai our God, to see speedily the glory of your might when you remove abominable idolatry from the earth and the idols that will totally be destroyed. When you perfect the world, okay, right there, that phrase is a phrase called Tikkun Olam. Now, one thing that you should know about this is it's spelled differently here than it is normally spelled. But this is one of the fundamental ideas of where the idea of Tikkun, reparation of the world, where it comes into play. Okay, so you will perfect the world. So this goes literally all the way back to Bereishit, the very beginning, and we'll talk more about that in just a few minutes. But it goes all the way back to Bereishit, and in Bereishit, we don't really hear this phrase, but we do when we start to read. We see the content of this. And we actually can now, looking back through history, we can see that it plays a part for us, okay? So when you perfect the world, this has the idea of it being restored to its original pristine state, okay? Under the kingdom of the Almighty. So again, you see here the multitudes of times that it refers to God as the King and him being the king over a kingdom, etc., over the kingdom of specifically here the Jewish people, but not just the Jewish people, also the Gentiles, and we'll talk more about that also. And all of mankind will call upon your name, and when you turn back to yourself, all the evildoers of the earth, they will recognize and know all of the inhabitants of the world, that every knee will bow to you and that all will take oaths by your name. Before you, Adonai, our God, they will kneel and bow down and give honor to your glorious name. And you will accept all, and the yoke of the kingdom you will soon reign over them forever and ever. For the kingdom is yours for all eternity. And you reign in glory, as it is written in your Torah. Adonai will reign forever and ever. As it is stated, Adonai will be king over all the world. And on that day, Adonai will be one, and his name will be one. And in your Torah, Adonai our God, it is written as follows. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Okay, the reason that this becomes vitally important, the fundamental times that it uses the concept of the kingdom and the fact that the kingdom is used for a purpose, and the primary purpose of the kingdom is to serve God's ultimate idea of ultimately, the end process is for God to create an environment that we can live in, where we can be very close to him, as close as can be humanly possible, and then eventually as we move from the days of Messiah into the Olam Haba, things will steadily increase with our interaction and our association with God, okay? I hope you enjoy the divine presence. If you don't enjoy the divine presence, it won't be a place where you will have a great amount of joy. But for those of us who love and want to dwell in the divine presence as much as we can, it will be our idea of absolute wonder and perfection. Okay, I want to go now to the book of Jeremiah, and chapter 29, and we're going to look at verse 7. And this is a very, very important idea for us, especially as we live and exist in the world today. And as I say, we live and exist in this world. I'm not excluding others, but I'm specifically saying, you know, as Jewish people, we exist in places other than Israel. And being in places other than Israel, what does that mean to us? Okay, verse 7 says, "And seek the peace of the city where I have caused you to be carried away captive." Okay, so wherever you've been exiled, the terminology here says to you, seek the peace of the city where that you have been exiled to. Okay, now that's my paraphrase. Okay, he said, "And pray to the Lord, for it is peace. You will have peace." So in other words, if you want to live in peace, then you have to pray for the city that you live in. That goes far beyond that. It's more than just praying. It's doing something. But the idea here is to first pray. Okay, when you have prayed the prayer where it says, pray for the peace of Jerusalem, those that love you or whatever will prosper. It does not say that in Hebrew. It says that if you pray for the peace of Jerusalem, you will have peace. But peace is a very in-depth, shalom is a very in-depth idea of being completely restored and not having any type of deficiency whatsoever. Okay, so here Hashem is speaking to Yirmiyahu, and he says, pray for the city that you live in. So some of us may be saying, well, you know, we live in this Gentile world, and, you know, the leaders are not good, or they're corrupt, or whatever might be. And yes, there's all kinds of that all over the world, and we know that. But our obligation is to pray for peace, and that doesn't mean that we just don't want fighting. It means that we want things to be restored back to the way that they should be, or that they should be made whole in the truest sense of what shalom means. I would encourage you, somewhere I've got a bookmarker that I made with all of the ideas of shalom. I'll try to maybe hunt it down and send you a copy of it. But shalom, it comes from a root called shalem. And shalem means to be completely whole, lacking nothing. And that's only a very brief statement about that. But nevertheless, it is the complex truth about all of that. Now, what I want to do is go to Ecclesiastes. And I want first 1 and 15. You didn't know we were going to play Bible drill tonight, did you? What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. 7 and 13. It seems to say something almost different. It said, consider the work of God. So you want to be involved in the work of God? This is your job. Consider the work of God, for who can make straight what has been made crooked? Okay? One more passage in chapter 12, verse 9. Moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge, and he pondered and sought out to set in order many proverbs. To set in order means to restore or put them back in their place, put them where they are. Now, it's very interesting here that it says that he taught people knowledge, because the word actually here in Hebrew, of course, is da'at. And this is a very, very, very deep idea and very, very deep subject. So that the preacher, who is Shlomo, I didn't know Adon Shlomo had a bunch of proverbs, but Adon Shlomo has been busy, I guess, where I haven't known that he was busy. But it says that he taught them da'at. Da'at is interesting because if we look, those of you who understand the tree in any shape, manner, and form, let's see if I got a copy of it here somewhere. I know I do. Da'at is at the very bottom of the top three. I don't know where it's at right now, so I'm not going to fuss with it. You'll have like a triangle of dots. You can imagine it in your mind. And so one is at the very top. And then just below that, one will be on the right side, one will be on the left side, and down below that, in many, many, many places, it's incognito. You don't see it. It's not even written there that it is da'at, but sometimes it will be the shaded-in circle that is directly below keter, or the crown, or the crown specifically. We'll call it the crown of Messiah. Now, that being said, what happens there is right below that, on right side is Chesed, and on the left side is Gevura, and the power to move from Chesed, which is one of the highest offices in, let's say, in the congregation, and one of the highest offices we can see in with regards to spiritual accomplishment. Those who have mastered Chesed are truly, truly masters in life, because not only have they mastered Chesed, they have also mastered everything that is below that. And so now they're ready to move to the next stage, and the next stage is actually not necessarily to be understood as da'at, but as bina, which is understanding. And then eventually they would be able to graduate to chokmah, which is wisdom. Okay, now, when you cross from chesed into bina, you have to cross the threshold of da'at. Now, you have heard, you know, many times the idea of the abyss. Da'at is the abyss. And it is a spiritual abyss. And for those who are trying to progress spiritually and trying to elevate themselves spiritually, the thing is that when we cross that threshold, or when we encounter da'at, what happens is you find out that you have some baggage. Now, I know you don't have it, but I have it. Okay, so you have baggage, and those things you need to get rid of before you can make yourself available in the concept of understanding. And so what happens is, once we come to that threshold, it is actually an acceleration or an elevation into the spiritual dynamic, and we leave behind many, many things that are negative in our life. And so it goes into the abyss. It's thrown into the abyss. Okay? So that's three verses, three places where you can see tikkun. And the idea of tikkun was there in Yirmiyahu. And it was for you to understand that you should pray for the place that you live in. And through your prayers, you, number one, you restore the city that you live in. You restore it not just to its original state, but to its original intent. Gibra Kibora. 1 second. Go ahead, I apologize.
Did you give three verses in Ecclesiastes or only two?
Three verses.
1 and 12:9. What was the second one?
7:13.
Hold on.
Then we did Yirmiyahu, what was it, 29:7?
Yeah, I've got that. It was just the middle of Ecclesiastes.
Okay. Now, to where I never turn to these passages, but let's go to Bereishit. Again.
I'll go there.
Again and again and again and again. You know, for the longest time, I had this phobia of having to keep going back to Bereishit. You know, how come you got to keep going back to Bereishit? You know, you haven't elevated beyond that. And then I learned all the great sages, not me, I'm just saying all the great sages, they always quote Bereishit because it's the source and the foundation for everything. So, you know, I'm kind of like, everybody know who George Washington Carver was? You know, he's the guy that wanted to know the peanut. That's about my place. So it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so this can use a lot of explanation, but we'll just leave it at that. And so what I would have assumed or learned from this passage and what I have held for many, many years is that when God originally made it, it was made exactly the way that he wanted it to be made. It was made in, let's say, true perfection. And then it goes to verse 2. It said, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Ruach Elohim, who according to the sages, in Midrash, I think it is, Midrash Rabbah, they say that the spirit here of Elohim is the spirit of Messiah, was not hovering over it. He was, his eminence will teach you well that it means to be agitating it. And he was agitating the surface of the waters. Why was he agitating it? Because now there was no light. Originally there had been a light, but now there is no light. And the light, absence of the light, all of you know that the absence of light will make things cooler. So in the daytime when the sun is at its peak, you know, you're at the warmest part of the day. Well, not quite, but necessarily, but that you understand the idea as it increases. And then as it moves into the darker periods of the night, you know, things tend to cool down. Unless you're somewhere like the Mojave Desert or something of that nature. Texas, I know they say it gets hot down there too, so. It doesn't get hot in Tennessee, so, you know, it's like a garden paradise. So, but the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. Now, what you find here is if you go to Jude, and we don't necessarily have to go there, but you understand that in Jude, that it says that the light bearers, and I'm paraphrasing, it says that they fell. They did not keep their first occupation. And so what they did is they fell. And the idea here now comes to the place of what we can explain as when God intended to create, he always intended to create humanity, mankind. But what he intended to do was give humanity the ability to not follow his commands And the ability, let's just say it plain and simple, he gave us the ability to sin. Okay? And sin basically means just to fail to do what he wants or fail to do what the Torah explicates as something that is our duty. Okay? So he intended to make humanity not like the angels, who are not forced or coerced, but they see things much differently. Okay, so for you and I, things have been hidden in a way that we do not see the consequence of our actions as readily as the angels or the Malachim do. Now, angels is a really, really bad word, but nevertheless, you will understand who I'm speaking of, because they are the creatures who are also messengers, the messengers of God. All right. Now, these light bearers fell. The chief light bearer fell, and I don't want to get people upset, but you understand that the term light bearer in transliteration is Lucifer. Okay, Lucifer is not a negative name. It's not the name of a devil. It's not the name of the devil. It's the name of someone who was to be the light bearer, the light bringer. Okay, so when he fell, he and most likely a third of the Malachim, those agents that were assigned to him, when they fell, what happened was all the lights went out. Okay? So you can see that the earth, it says it was without form and void. And what happens? It says that the spirit of Messiah began to agitate the waters, and the agitation of the waters is to warm the waters so that there would be life in the water. All right, I'm not going into any scientific ideas here. I'm just telling you those are the fundamentals, all right? Now, this said, somebody had to take the job of the light bearer, okay? And so that job was given to Messiah, all right? So, you know, some Christian scholars say, you ask them, where is the first mention of Messiah? And generally, they will say in Genesis 3:15. And in Genesis 3:15, it's where it talks about the heel of literally a Messiah, but it talks about the woman who the seed of the woman would strike the head of the serpent and bruise the head of the serpent, and the serpent would strike the heel of man and cause difficulty. When it uses that idea of heel and the serpent striking the heel, it is, number one, the idea of your conduct. It always wants to impede your conduct, okay? So if it strikes your heel, it's striking your walk. And what it's trying to do is impede the way you progress in the things of godliness, etc. Okay, but the true beginning of where Messiah is located, according to the sages, is in verse 2, where it says, Ruach Elohim, or the Spirit of God, and that he here began to do this. And then, go verse 3, said, then God said, let there be light, and there was light. So what we have here is a command of God, and then the response of the agent to accomplish what God said. Okay, so you understand that Messiah is considered to be the creator. Messiah is not the creator in the sense of the original idea. What you see here is the structure of, I'll give an order, God gives the order, and that the order as it's given is then carried out by his agents. In this particular case, we see that the agent is Messiah, and Messiah is accomplishing this idea of bringing light. Okay, now it's very complex here, because there's what is called the Or Haganus, and that is the original light, and the primordial light, and that is the light of Messiah, not the light of the first light bearer, okay? But not to aggravate anyone, but now there is a new light bearer, and so you could say that the phrase Lucifer, which means light bearer, it's only a title. So it's not the name of the devil. It's only a title of one who bears the light. Okay? So if you got a guy that makes sure that all the lights in the city work, then he's the light bringer or whatever. You could call him Lucifer or whatever you want to. And please don't get confused or upset or try to drag this off into some direction. But now the light bearer, Lucifer, is Messiah. He's the light bringer, okay? He's the one who bears the light, and he bears a light that is literally above the light of the fallen previous light bearer. Now, what you see from verse 1 to verse 2 is that there's something here that's happened that we didn't see. But that is that the light bearer, the original light bearer in his entourage, they have become upset with God because they have been created in such a way that failure or sin is not an option that they would generally choose to follow. Okay? If you were and I were standing on the edge of, you know, the Grand Canyon looking down, you know, we would understand not to walk any farther because there's a consequence there. But those consequences for us with regard to sin are many times obscured. Okay, so you do not see the result of what's going to happen if you disobey God in a particular instance. You're wrestling with, literally, your Yetzer Hara, Tov is wrestling with your Yetzer Hara, and you're wrestling inside of yourself, and what happens is that the enemy or the Yetzer Hara tries to disguise the truth of the situation and say that there's not going to be any punishment, or the punishment is not all of that, and on and on and on. So the idea here is that, you know, the Malachim, the angels, they're perfectly aware if they do something wrong of the consequences, much like it would be for you, I, or I, if we were standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon, knowing not to step farther, okay? Now, so there's been this catastrophe between verse 1 and verse 2. And so now what you have is that it has to all be put back together to its originally intended idea. Now this goes further if you go to the failure of Adam. And one of the things I have said in the past and taught in one of the Torah Sederim is that sin did not begin with Adam. Sin began with the light bearer who refused to do God's choice. Okay? Adam refused to do God's choice. And what Adam, the result of Adam's rebellion or his sin is death. Okay? Death did not exist in the sin of Lucifer, the original light bearer. It did not exist. Death was not an issue, okay? Because these beings are created in such a way that it's very hard to describe to some people the idea of the light bearers, or excuse me, not just the light bearers, but the Malachim, okay? Paul calls them principalities, powers, etc. And he doesn't call them all power, all angels. He calls them these powers, these energies, these things. And so the whole point is that the angel only lasts as long as the mission. Okay, so once his mission is over, then he's done. Okay, but then you do have many Malachim, many angels, if you will call them such, that have a mission that is, you know, eternal in some respects. Okay, so we expect Malachim angels like Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, all of these that are ministering spirits to minister to Israel, they endure, and they will most likely endure for an eternity because they have an association with the well-being of the B'nai Israel, the children of Israel. Okay, but there are others that are created, and as soon as they accomplish their task, that's the end of their job, you know. Sometimes you create certain things, but you only create the tool to do one specific job, and then when it's over with, you don't need the tool anymore. Okay, it goes in the trash. All right, so what you have is now they call these that failed, they call them angels of darkness. Why are they called angels of darkness? Because in their absence or in their defection, they brought darkness to the earth. Okay? But as we progress from the sin or the failure or the disobedience of the light bearer to the disobedience of Adam, we see that the consequence for Adam's failure or his rebellion is death. Okay? And so, the consequence, and this is where many people misunderstand the idea of the Torah and the law. And now that I have enjoyed myself by going to Genesis, having read there, let's go to Romans chapter 8 for a second and we'll explain something from there. He said there's now, in verse chapter 8, verse 1, there's no condemnation to those who are in Yeshua HaMashiach, who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. For the law of the Spirit of life in Messiah has made me free from the law of sin and death. Many people think that this law that is being spoken of here is the Torah. But it is not the Torah. It is not literally a law. This word can be used to understand it's a principle. Okay, so what is the principle of sin and death? The principle of sin and death is you sin, you die. That's it. You don't have any recourse. Okay, but there's a way in Yeshua to circumvent this. Okay, but backing up to the first verse, it said there's no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus or Messiah, Yeshua HaMashiach. What this means is not that you get a get-out-of-jail-free card. It means that the conduct of those who belong to Yeshua is of such a high standard that they're not going to be brought into condemnation because they're following the Torah. Not possible? Well, let's see here. There's a verse to deal with that too. Luke 1, 5. And there was in the days of Herod, the king of Yehuda, a certain Cohen named Zechariah, of the division of Abijah. And his wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elisheba. And they were both righteous before God, walking in all of the commandments and the ordinances of the Lord, blameless or perfect. So don't think that the Torah cannot be followed or that it is impossible to do. Hashem said that you can do it. The word's in your mouth and it's right close to you. So that has the idea of what? That means that what we do is we rehearse the words of the Torah. And only by knowing what the Torah says can we find out what sin is, okay? And the rebellion against God. So now what I have fundamentally tried to do is to lay out for you the idea that tikkun literally goes all the way back to the beginning. But in the verses such as Yirmiyahu 29, what you understand is that you and I are involved in it. And you and I must be involved in it. Now, there is some idea that as we read from the Eleinu, that God has to perfect the world. And that is absolutely the truth. But, again, the kingdom always goes back to agency. Somebody has to be the judge. Somebody has to be the one who heralds these things that are said to whoever. Okay, so let's put it like this. You know, back to the Yirmiyahu 29, and that is the where you live is not, it's almost that you don't have a choice where you live. Yeah, I don't know if Yonair is going to move. He's going to change where he goes. But we can say that Adon Avinair is being sent to a new location. It's not problematic. It's not anything wrong with that whatsoever. It's just he's sent to a new city. So that means his occupation where he's at is completed. That does not mean the place is perfect, but it means that his occupation there has ceased and he's going to another place. Okay, for you and I, it's not by accident that you live where you live. It is not an accident at all. And in some respects, we say with a bit of jest that we understand that, you know, we didn't have a choice in the matter. God wanted us to be here. This is where we're at. And so it's kind of like you have to bloom wherever God has planted you. So you've been put in a place where you are a part and you form a sphere or a circle where that you have influence. You have influence in the area where you live. And that is by God's design that you live there and that you exert influence over that area. Now, sometimes you may be actively involved in different things and you can bring about this idea to Kuhn, which we'll try to unfold more in the next lesson or two. But the idea of this whole thing is that you're placed right exactly where God wants you to be. He said for you, and we say this in trying to understand where we're at and what we're involved in, we're what? We're in a place of exile. The exile is not being exiled from Israel. As much as I love to be in Israel, is the number of times that I've been, you know, it is an elation. But the thing is that it's not Israel. Not everybody should try to quote make Aliyah and go back to Israel, because they're planted in a place where God has placed them, and where God has placed them is a place where that they're in a particular sphere of influence, where that their presence in that place is vital. So it's not by accident you're where you're at. You're there because you're needed there, and your presence is needed there. Whether it's prayer, whether it's teaching people, no matter what the full consequence of your being in that place where you live, God's placed you there for a very specific reason. And so sometimes you can look around the people that are in your sphere of influence and you can see them and you can say, this is a person who needs spiritual attention or help or otherwise. And so you may not even need to say anything specifically about God, etc., but you can just help them. You might give them, a sandwich, or you might, whatever. You might give them an encouraged word. You're doing good today. That looks good. Whatever it might be. Okay. But now I will begin to sum up here to say that when we take this concept of trying to repair, tikkun, rectify, and all the other adjectives that go along with it, that it is very complex, and that it's very deep, and that every action that you and I are involved in is in some way associated with this idea of repair and tikkun. So I think of, when I think of tikkun on a perhaps, let's say, more mundane level, I'm talking about the place where I work. I realize that I have an obligation not just to try to bring about tikkun in a spiritual way where I try to restore spiritual truth as a part of my occupation and association with their eminences and the Torah Seder, etc. But I think also in relationship to my secular employment. And so one of the things that is vital for me is my integrity. So my integrity has brought me to the place that certain people want me to come do their work for them. It's not a boast. It's actually a tremendous responsibility. And so that means all the things that I do are to be correct, to be done correctly. Not to try to shave corners here or there because it's easier that way, and or whatever might be the case. But I say that with regard to myself and the things that I do as for my occupation. But obviously, I also can speak on the level of spiritual tikkun and those things as well. But when you stop to think about this, the impact. So if you go to the doctor, the doctor may try to give you medicine or diagnose this or that. Or if you have to go to court or if you have to, whatever it might be, you can stop and make a list of all of the occupations that there could be in our community. And you know that tikkun means that every one of those occupations is doing it right. If it's going to be tikkun and repair, that means it has to be done right. Now, the book and the favorite saying of mine, that it's one I've adopted from Luzzatto, the Ramchal, and that is that God is going to, out of all of the humans and humanity that exists on the earth and comes and goes, he's going to create a perfected community. And that perfected community is what he wants to dwell close to him, with him, etc. That being said, you, I hope, can grasp the idea of the depth of a perfected community. Now, this doesn't just mean that we're all going to wear white and float around on whatever, but at the same time, the concept, as it's been given by the prophet, said that we will be in a place where we do not harm others and others do not harm us. And in this world today, that's a very difficult thing to say, because not so much that we do not harm others, but others harm us. But as the Ramchal says, those that are not going to labor toward that relationship with God and that relationship with humanity will be cast aside. And we will eventually make the divine, or make the perfected community, and that's what we will be able to live with. And, you know, having been to Israel more than once, one of the things that I love about going to Israel is that you don't have to worry about the food. Okay, so, you know, when I go to the grocery store, you women go to the grocery store, what do? You pick up the can and you look in the can, you're looking for what? You're looking for the heksha. Okay, or if you know that certain foods vegetables, etc., don't necessarily need a Hexer. But then again, if you're going to buy canned goods, you know, what did they put in this? Does this have some sort of an animal fat? Or you understand what I'm saying? So you always pick up the can or the product, and you look, and you're looking for the Hexer. You want to know if this is legitimate. It's something that is trustworthy, okay? But in Israel, when you're in, you know, Jerusalem and some of the places, you don't have to pick up the can and look to see if it has a Hexer. You know the food is kosher. That's all there is to it. Now, the only trouble could develop is if you tried to do something like, for example, mix milk and meat, but, you know, there's a place I love to go. It's just up not far from a little place called Shroshim, and the promenade that's there in Israel, and it's called the Burger Bar. Okay, you know, so they make this wonderful, wonderful hamburger, and you know, for us that are in the West, you know, that's the great detail. But the one thing they don't serve is they don't serve cheeseburgers. And if you go outside to sit down in the tables, there is a section for those that are eating hamburgers, and then across the street there's a dairy bar. Okay, so there's a place for you to sit if you're on the dairy bar, and there's a place for you to sit if you're in a burger. And they kind of try to make sure that you don't cross over that line with one product to the other. You don't want somebody eating his hamburger or whatever it might be, say, hey, you want to, let me try that ice cream cone you got there or whatever. So the ice cream would be kosher, but there's rules to all of that, etc. Okay, so that said, I'm going to close here, but I will give you an opportunity to make any questions or comments that you wish before we go. Read the Eleinu. It's a wonderful, wonderful prayer. Pray the Eleinu. Comments, questions. Everybody understood perfectly. Good. That's what I like. Class, it's on top. Okay, so we'll leave with that, and we pray that everybody have a most wonderful Shabbat, and we'll see you next Thursday. Shalom, shalom.